From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in 2050. By then, the world will have long since decided whether to take climate change seriously enough. Several new reports point to 2050 as a benchmark year, and there is tremendous work to do. Either we reduce emissions by roughly 80% by 2050, or we begin to endure a world that is irreversibly warmer with serious consequences. But cutting emissions by 80%, or 72% if you read the new UN report, is about more than just driving a Prius or recycling or turning off the lights when you leave the house. We're talking about massive changes, major policy shifts. We're talking about more than just the United States, potentially. We'll have to get India and China on board, for starters. That has never been easy. Now, the Sierra Club says it can start right in our individual communities. And tonight, the Sierra Club is hosting an event in Rochester featuring Mark Lowry. Mark is a climate policy analyst with the DEC. He's the manager of the Climate Smart Communities Program. And first, he's with us on Connections for the Hour. Mark, thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Evan.
Frank Reagan is here as well. Peter Debs is here. Frank's the former chair of the Rochester Regional Group of Sierra Club. Peter, the current chair. I hope I have you not mixed up, gentlemen.
Glad to be here.
That's correct.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thanks for being here. Tonight, let's have Peter tell us exactly what's going on tonight. Let's start there.
All right. Well, tonight we have provided an opportunity for representatives from the various communities around our area to hear about the real effects of climate change that are predicted for our area and what communities can begin doing to prepare for those things rather than waiting until they're a crisis stage.
Okay. Where can people go tonight and for more information?
All right. They should come to the Unitarian Church on Winton Road. That's the first Unitarian Church. And we have an initial part of the program where they can walk around and see various environmental groups that are in our area and what they do. And then the program starts at 7 o'clock and includes a community discussion following a presentation by Mark.
Okay. And, you know, the UN's out with this new report on just how much has to be done to reverse warming trends. By 2050, their estimate is that we have to cut emissions drastically, at least 41%, as much as 72%. I asked our Twitter followers if they believe the world can do it, and the short answer is no. Mark, what do you think?
Experts tell us it's possible. It will take a concerted effort at all levels, from individuals, local communities, the states, the nations, and the international community. But the experts say we can do it if we have the will. They also say it won't cost us all that much. The report that was issued this past week from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 3 estimates that the annualized reduction in consumption is 600ths of a percentage point. That's a very small reduction in consumption, annual consumption, that would be required to make the investments to achieve the necessary reductions.
This is where I feel like there's some cognitive dissonance, because that report does indeed say that a massive clean energy push could shave at least 600ths of a percent off of global growth each year. Now, the critics almost immediately came out and said it's got to be more than that. The UN report says no, that's their initial report. And is there a danger, Mark, to saying, well, it's only, if we do all the hard work, it's only 6 hundredths of a percent of global growth? That makes it sound easy. This is, if you really want to get there, this is not going to be easy, is it?
It's not going to be easy, but primarily not because we don't have the technology. It's not going to be easy because we have lacked the political will to do so, because there are many well-vested interests in our current technology, because fossil fuel companies have already made and continue to make tremendous investment in finding fossil fuel resources that they appear to have every intent to sell to us to combust. The private or the corporate fossil fuel companies and the sovereign fossil fuel companies around the world currently own about five times more fossil fuel reserves than scientists say we can safely burn. And so that raises the question of why they are investing in dirtier sources, why they are investing in trying to drill in more dangerous places, more dangerous both for the environment and for the individuals who are working on those sites. They apparently continue to believe that they will be able to burn all this material.
We're talking to Mark Lowry and also Peter Debs and Frank Reagan. They're from the chapter of, hold on a second, the Rochester Regional Group of the Sierra Club, that's where they're from. Mark is with us. He's speaking tonight in Rochester. And if you want to join the conversation about whether the world and this country has the political will to make the policy changes necessary to reverse some warming trends, join the conversation, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And we're going to hit a lot of different subjects here, and we are going to kind of go through point by point on where Mark is going to be going tonight. But you mentioned fossil fuels. And when we talk about policy change, we saw, I don't know if it was 10 years ago now, maybe 10 years ago, 8, 10 years ago. I remember Governor Pataki being out in Pembroke, Medina for the opening of a new corn-based ethanol plant. Corn-based ethanol was the future. And that turned out to be a pretty poorly vetted flop there. And now a lot of people say, well, that was a government policy, and that was a terrible mistake. Why do we trust policy decisions to make any impact on warming?
Well, we always have to do our best when we make policy decisions to be sure they are both scientifically grounded and grounded well economically. I would agree that corn-based ethanol is not a good policy. Burning food in our fuel tanks does not seem to make much sense. We certainly believe that biofuels will be a necessary part of our energy mix in the future, but we always preface that in the Office of Climate Change by saying sustainable biofuels, and corn ethanol probably is not.
Okay, we'll get more into energy as we go throughout the hour here on Connections as we talk about how to deal with climate change. Now, Mark's going to be happy to hear that I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on point one, which is the science of it, and that's because, Mark, I don't have a whole lot of patience for the conversation about whether this is happening or not. I trust scientists. I trust the fact that scientists are open to new information and new evidence, but there is a scientific consensus that that it is happening. We've interviewed paleoclimatologists on this program who've spent months in Antarctica and other places, and we understand that it's happening. But you are going to start tonight with a little bit of the science to help people see it. And how do you frame it for people who do have questions? Because I don't mean to be condescending. I get that it can be hard to understand. How do you start the science part of it?
I start off with pretty much the same statement you just made. I also am not a climatologist. Our office, the Office of Climate Change, does not have a climatologist or even a meteorologist on staff. We look at what seems to be the best consensus science from the international science community, from the community of scientists in New York State. And New York State is very fortunate in having access to researchers at some of the leading climate research universities in the world. And we rely on them for the science and base our policy decisions on what appears to be the best consensus science. So when I talk about the science, I recognize that to a large extent the debate about climate change in this nation, at least, has become politicized to the point where we forget the science, and many people want to ignore the science, but we really can't make good policy decisions if we ignore that science. And so what I try to do is start with the basics and walk them through it fairly slowly in a way that I hope is digestible by the layperson.
And that'll happen tonight at the event. But here's where I think it becomes political. I think what's happening is there's two different questions. There's the scientific question, is it happening or not? And then there's the policy question, what do you do about it? And I think the policy is so divided that it has led some to say, I think some people understandably, or at least in their mind, pretty understandably think we can't stop this, and therefore all of these obstreperous policies that are being pushed at us are misguided. Therefore, they take up the tack that says it's not happening at all. I think that's kind of my side of it.
And I think that's what happens. When you tell someone that what you're doing may be making the world less inhabitable for your great-grandchildren or for even your children, or natural resources like polar bears or pikas or whatever it may be, because most people don't want to be perceived as evil or greedy, they seem to have to take on, even subconsciously, this idea, well, it's not really happening. That excuses my behavior. If I'm not willing to change my behavior, then I have to rationalize about what the result of that behavior is.
Yeah, and that may be the case, but I also think there's a lot of folks who read about this issue and they think there isn't much we can do to change it, and therefore a big policy shift is only going to be an economically harmful thing to do with no good climate consequence. And I hope I'm wrong, but let me read to you and the good news is this is 5 years old now, and a lot changes in 5 years, but this is from NPR, a story 5 years ago, and the title of the story is Global Warming is Irreversible, study says. It comes from author Susan Solomon, who is among the world's top climate scientists. She says, quote, "We're used to thinking about pollution problems as things we can fix. Smog, we just cut back and everything will be better later. Or haze, you know, it can go away pretty quickly." But Solomon and colleagues suggest in a new study, this is 2009, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it is not true for the most abundant greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. Turning off the carbon dioxide emissions won't stop global warming. Quote, "People have imagined that if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide, that the climate would go back to normal in 100 or 200 years. What we're showing here is that's not right. It's essentially an irreversible change that will last more than 1,000 years.
I would agree with that, that in fact, because carbon dioxide is such a long-lived molecule when it's in the atmosphere, a single molecule of carbon dioxide will spend potentially several hundred years into the atmosphere once it's emitted. We have already, we as humans, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, emitted enough carbon dioxide to raise the atmospheric CO2 levels from about 280 parts per million up about 40%, just shy of 400 parts per million. That we will never go back down, likely, to 250 to 280. So, yes, it's true. We can't stop climate change because it's already happening. What we can do is mitigate climate change, mitigate our emissions, and reduce the risks that we face. This is all about assessing what the risk is. Everything that we do to enhance global warming, to make the Earth warm faster, enhances the risk of untoward things happening, whether it's climatic disasters or result in economic problems. But by reducing the amount of CO2 and other greenhouse gases we emit, the less warming we will have and the less risk that we and our grandchildren will encounter.
All right. So in other words, it's unlikely that we can fully reverse the effects, but we can at least slow the effects.
That's correct. There are scientists who argue, and it would be great if we can survive allowing our CO2 concentration in the atmosphere to get to about 450 parts per million. If that trend is then reversed and we come back down to 350 or so. But there's no technology at this point that seems that provides a clear pathway for doing that. So we probably should get used to living in a 400 to 450 parts per million world at the very least.
Is there, and you maybe you're sort of touching on it here, and forgive my lack of science understanding on this question, but when I hear debates about the policy, I hear questions about, can we create a world with much fewer emissions and slow warming effectively, or can we trust science to do carbon reduction from the atmosphere? Are there scientific gains coming that will help on that way?
Nothing appears very promising at this point. Mm-hmm. There has been talk about really essentially using what's called biosequestration, where you would grow biomass in the form of trees or some herbaceous material that would draw carbon out of the air, carbon dioxide out of the air, convert it to carbon, and then you would use that material in place of fossil fuel. But the scale of operation that it would take to actually reduce atmospheric CO2 concentrations is really incomprehensible.
All right, I'm depressed. Let's wrap it up, guys. Have a good day.
Well, don't be depressed because, you know, the result of addressing climate change means that we can in many ways make the world a better place. When we talk about making our communities more livable, less car-centric, when we talk about, many of our pollution problems are associated with fossil fuels. If we were not combusting fossil fuels, much of our air pollution regulations could go away because we simply wouldn't be emitting things that do bad things to our lungs and to our heart and so forth.
Got an email this morning when they knew that Mark was coming on the program. And again, if you're just joining us here, Mark Lowry is a climate policy analyst with the state DEC. He's the manager of the Climate Smart Communities program. He's in Rochester for an event tonight. And we're going to in a few minutes, we're going to start getting into what the Climate Smart Communities program is and how it can impact the Rochester Finger Lakes area. But I had an email this morning on the issue of fossil fuels and heard from a listener who said, fossil fuels, coal and oil are dirty. We keep burning them, but we stand in the way of gas, which is at least cleaner than coal and oil. And that I know fracking is a sensitive debate, but let me start with the premise question here. Is natural gas cleaner than coal and oil?
Natural gas is cleaner than coal and oil. It emits about half the CO2 per unit energy than does coal.
Okay. And therefore, is it either, people call it a bridge fuel, a bridge to cleaner energy, or on its own, is it a worthwhile goal just because it's cleaner than coal and oil?
It has the potential to be a bridge fuel if we use it properly, and that means knowing what's on the other side of that bridge. Otherwise,
we don't, right?
We don't know.
Yeah.
Most analysts that I read indicate that, our own visioning that was done a few years ago for New York State showed that to achieve an 80 by 50 reduction goal, to reduce our emissions by 80% by 2050, would require us to decarbonize both our transportation sector and our electricity generation sector.
And we're living on carbon.
And so we certainly cannot continue to burn natural gas even beyond 2050.
Okay.
So that means that what we really should probably be looking at are policies that would allow one generation of gas power plants. So a policy probably including a price on carbon emissions that would allow gas to economically replace coal and oil, which actually is a very small part of New York's energy generation mix as it is, but then have a rising, that price on carbon rising fast enough and predictably enough that the utilities know that they have to replace that first generation of gas plants with renewable energy by 2050. So when this generation of gas turbines is ready to retire, we don't install new gas turbines, we put in renewables, replace them with renewables.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. And I certainly am not going to make the whole hour on fracking, which will be a relief to you. But I know that there is a question of why the DEC has taken so long to even make a decision in the state on that.
I can't comment on that.
Okay. All right. So that's not your arena?
It's not my arena, and it is a decision right now. The decision is open before the DEC, and the DEC is waiting for the health study.
Okay. When it comes to nuclear power, we had a comment, and I'm trying to sift through a pile of papers here preparing for this interview, but we had some comments online this morning, and Pat McDermott on Twitter writes to us, I asked the question, can we realistically change our policy and cut emissions enough by 2050 to make it a dent? And he says yes, but one of the best possibilities to allow this, thorium nuclear power, oh boy, that might be over my head, but nuclear power is underdeveloped. Where are we going with nuclear power and where do you think we should go?
The draft state energy plan does not, to my knowledge, address nuclear power, so I can't comment on what the state policy might be. There are people who argue both sides. There are people who argue that we cannot achieve an 80 by 50 reduction goal without using nuclear power in New York State. There are others who argue that we can. Thorium reactors certainly have seem to be safer, and I have very limited knowledge in this area, I'll admit, but there are people who believe that especially thorium reactors provide a good pathway to a cleaner future.
So thorium nuclear reactors not currently in the state plans, maybe we'll see that change.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Don't know.
Okay. 263-WXXI, and I see the phone starting to light up, 263-9994. Let's take a quick call, and then we're going to get more into what Mark's talking about tonight. Go ahead, Stephen. Thanks for calling Connections.
Yes. I'd like to make a point that I personally think that one of the biggest obstacles we're facing with dealing with this problem is world population growth. And personally, I've seen it in my lifetime go from somewhere around 2 billion to over 7 billion. If we could get back down to 2 billion somehow without, I think if we don't deal with that problem, it'll probably wind up doing it self-destructively, but we could probably organize and somehow give people incentives in this world not to have so many children and to limit it so that we could bring down the population. I think that would be the best solution to this problem, in conjunction with some type of scientific research and development that will solve the way we use energy now and go to cleaner sources.
We're going to 9 billion before we go back to 2 billion, I think, Stephen, barring something catastrophic, don't you think?
Yeah, but we need some kind of incentives in this world. We got to start rewarding people for doing that and cooperating and penalize people that don't. I think we need to do that somehow in this world through, I don't know how right now, I've made some suggestions already, writing to Congress people and senators and that about that. They probably think my ideas are a little extreme, but that personally is what I think we need to do, along with what you've been talking about.
Well, thanks for the call, Stephen, and we're not going back to 2 billion people, but population control is, that's not the first time it's come up in this, so let me kick it over to our guests from the local Sierra Club. And Peter, what do you think?
Well, I'm glad that was raised, and it's a tricky issue. We're a country that is very strongly based in religion, and in that sense, it's difficult for us to talk about that. And yet it's an essential topic that we do have to raise. So I'm glad the caller did that. I think we have to be very careful as we approach it, too, because if you actually talk about population by itself, you have to take into another thing, and that is, what does that population consume? And so you can't just compare, say, and think about, say, a country like India or China that has a massive population as being the major culprit, when a population that's much smaller, like ours, consumes much more of the world's resources. So by initiating a population policy and program in our country, we could provide a very valuable leadership basis for the world, and we really would have to do that for our country first before we could go out and preach it.
But is it realistic? And well, I'll let Mark jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, certainly don't dispute the potential environmental benefits of reducing the global population. However, we can't rely on that as a solution to climate change, simply because even if we stopped having kids tomorrow, we would still have 7 billion people on Earth consuming and emitting greenhouse gases, and natural attrition of the population is not going to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions fast enough.
When you talk about, Mark, when you talk about, we don't know what's on the other side of the bridge, and if this country taps more into shale gas, natural gas, when it's talked about as a bridge fuel, they're talking about from coal and oil to something cleaner. Give me a sense for what the viable options look like right now.
For utility scale, it's really wind and solar. There are other options, geothermal and hydro where it's available, but I think you're mostly, most people talk about renewables in the form of, again, utility scale solar and utility scale wind, and supplemented by smaller things like medium and small wind.
I feel like 10 years ago there was a lot of talk about cellulosic ethanol, switchgrass. Have those gone the way of corn-based
ethanol? No, there's
ethanol?
Still active research in those areas.
Algae.
Those are all what we, when I use the term sustainable biofuels, they would fall under that classification. And there's a lot of active research going on in New York State and demonstration projects, pilot projects, some of which are funded through NYSERDA. And trying to bring some of that up to scale, we will mostly need by 2050 the sustainable biofuels that we'll be able to produce will mostly be necessary for places where electrification won't work, and that includes aviation and heavy duty vehicles. So that's where most of our sustainable biofuels will be going.
All right, 263-WXXI. One more quick call, and then we'll take a short break here. But let's get one more call in here before the shortest break in radio. John, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, John.
Hi, two quick questions, and I'll take the answers off the air. Number one, what are the environmental effects of the introduction of airplane exhaust to the driest levels of the atmosphere? And two, what would be the benefits of asking our pilots to keep it under 10,000 feet? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Certainly, water vapor is a strong greenhouse gas. It's actually a stronger greenhouse gas than is carbon dioxide. Frankly, I don't have technical information on how much of an effect it actually has relative to other greenhouse gases, nor can I respond to the question about keeping them under 10,000 feet.
Okay. We are going to take a very, very short break. When we come back, if you're just joining us here, the Sierra Club Local has an event tonight, and Mark Lowry is here for that. We're going to tell you more about that and more about what these climate smart communities are and how they hope Rochester and the Finger Lakes and Western New York becomes one. If you're on the phone, stay right there. We'll get to you right when we come back. But for now, I'm Evan Dustin, and you're listening to Member Supported Public Radio. And I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. My colleague Helen Bianduti Hofer is here. She's talking about Thursday Need to Know, 8 p.m. WXXI TV. What's coming up?
That's right. Well, we sit down with the owner of the Rochester Razor Sharks. They had this big win this week for the Professional Basketball League Championship. But he's talking about what's next for the team, the possibility of a new home. There may be some momentum building with that. We may hear something as soon as next month. So we discussed that just a little bit. Another aspect of the program, two young men, I've got their book here, Jeremiah and Joshua West, and they wrote a book called Champions of Change. And we talk a lot, Evan, you know this, we talk about the issues all the time. And then this is a perfect example of two young people just making that a special dent when it comes to those issues. And they're trying to get their peers to be change agents, not just here in Rochester. They are going all over the U.S. They do workshops with kids, teach them how to tell their story. They're entrepreneurs. Talk to them about saving their money and giving back. Just a great interview with them. And lastly, I've got Palathon Char of the South Sudan Village Care Foundation. And he is on set with me because we're talking all about next week's screening of Schools for South Sudan. He was featured in the documentary, and he's giving us an update on where things stand and giving Rochester some new news with what's going on right now.
Screening next week when?
That's Tuesday, April 22nd at 6:30 at the Little Theater.
At the Little Theater. We're going to talk to you more on Monday.
Absolutely.
About that. So we'll see you back here at noon. We'll see you tonight, 8 p.m., WXXI TV.
Yes. Thank
That's
you.
Need to Know Rochester, and my colleague Helen Bianduti Hofer. Thank you very much, Helen. We're back now talking about what's going on in Rochester tonight. The Sierra Club has a big event, and we want Frank and Peter to help describe what is going on in Rochester tonight. Peter, for our listeners just joining us, what's going on? What can they take part in tonight?
Well, we've brought Mark Lowry from the office, the Department of Environmental Conservation's Office of Climate Change, to Rochester to explain what the effects of climate change are going to be as predicted in our area, and also how communities can respond to this, to plan ahead, to prevent crises, and join a program called Climate Smart Communities. And as of now, there are only three, with a fourth one, Brighton, coming on board. Victor, the city of Rochester, and Irondequoit have already signed a pledge for this program. But most of the rest of the communities around us have not, and we feel it's critical to get these communities on board, and we have thus provided an easy way for them to find out about the program and take action.
Frank, you said that compared to the rest of the state, we could do a little bit better in that, you think?
Yeah, I think west of Syracuse, Mark, it doesn't look too many communities. One of the reasons why we wanted to have this program is to really give a sense of legitimacy to the climate change issue by bringing an expert like Mark with the state's program to deal with. I think one of the things in the Rochester area, there's a lot of climate science. We don't talk much about it. When actually there's a lot of things going with the Rochester's program for alternative transportation is a big program, a lot of bicycle riding. Things are actually happening, but we aren't connecting the dots. So what we're hoping with this program tonight is to bring in the community and really talk about it, not about just all the science and everything, but how people feel about it. It's kind of like an old town hall kind of meeting where people gather together. We were hoping for hundreds of people who just thought about it, who got their opinions, and want to join their neighbors, not sitting at your computer, but actually coming and talking being able to discuss this issue, whether you believe it or not. I think part of the problem is there's a sense of unreality about it. And that's in spite of right now there's a very important television program, Years of Living Dangerously. We've got some major stars doing a top-notch program on how important climate change is. And also there's been major stories out of the IPCC saying that if we don't get moving on climate change, we can see a 4 or 5 degrees Celsius rise by the end of the century, which is almost unlivable. So it's the dissonance between what we're seeing in the news, what we're seeing in parts of the media, and then what we see around Rochester. It's almost like we're living in two different worlds. So we're hoping to bring people together, bring in an expert like Mark, and really have something we usually don't have, a real town conversation about it.
All right. Phone calls now, because we've got a bunch piling up, and then we're going to get back to tonight's program. John in the city. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I've got to I'd like to hear the guest comments on a couple things that I've heard and read. In 2008, there was a study that said that there were 31,000 so-called scientists, meteorologists, etc., that made a declaration that man-made climate change really isn't there, and it's something perpetrated.
It's there, John.
And well,
it's not up for scientific debate, but go ahead.
Well, you sound like Al Gore. The debate is over.
No.
I don't think it's over. Man-made climate change really isn't there. Climate change is there, and I think I'd like to get the guest's thought on the sun. The sun creates a lot of climate change throughout our solar system. In fact, on Mars, my understanding is the temperature on Mars has risen because of the activities of the sun. And I would submit that has a lot to do with Earth, too. The other issue is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a necessity for plant life on Earth. And the fact that carbon dioxide is sort of an evil substance or chemical is I think bogus. I think there's a lot of things here that.
All right, John, hold on. And you've gotten to know me as a host over the last 4 months here. I'll be the first to tell you that I think Al Gore was a bad messenger on this issue because it instantly made people feel politicized with it. And I've heard many people, Guy Harrison, who's a classic American skeptic, said, we know scientifically that climate change is happening, but we need maybe fewer political big names and characters out of it, because then it feels like a policy debate that people don't want to listen to. So, but anyway, to your points, and I know Mark was taking notes, and John, I do appreciate the call. Go ahead, Mark.
The caller is referring to, I believe, the Oregon Project, which purports to have the signatures of 30,000 or more. What it claims to be scientists, actually, when you look at what the qualifications to be a scientist were to sign that petition, whereas I believe if you had a bachelor's degree in any discipline, you could call yourself a scientist and sign that petition. So when we look at what is the consensus science, we are looking at what do published climate scientists tell us, what do we hear from the several hundred that contribute to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report tell us, not what some self-selected group of people who have bachelor's degrees in English or computer science.
And what do the actual climate scientists, like Vas Petrenko, a paleoclimatologist who was on this program in January, what do they tell you?
They tell us that man has pushed CO2 concentrations from 280 parts per million to 400, that the basic physics and chemistry, what we know about the effects of carbon dioxide and how it traps heat in the atmosphere, all tell us explain what has been observed, which is an increase in global temperature of about 8/10 of a degree centigrade since the Industrial Revolution. And the models that these people put together tell us that, just as Frank said, if we continue business as usual, our atmosphere will likely warm by 4 to 5 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. With regard to solar as an influence, solar is one of several things that influence climate change. It is what climatologists call radiative forcing. But in fact, climatologists have been able to correct for that solar output. and model it as well as the other forcings, the other factors that affect global temperatures. And the only factor that can explain the recently observed warming is the known effect of greenhouse gases. Again, carbon dioxide is not a poison. No one has claimed it's a poison. It is vital to life, but so is water. And we can certainly drown in water, and we are essentially drowning or baking our ecosystem with CO2.
And for folks like John, that doesn't necessarily – that's not a political statement. The political debate's on the policy side, and that's partially why Mark's here, and that's why the Sierra Club's here. They've got to convince you that there's a way to make an impact here before you either change and get away from carbon, et cetera. That's the case they're making, and you can make up your own mind about whether you're persuaded. Judith, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Judith.
Oh, hello. I've been listening to this with great interest, and recently – I'm sure on NPR, the report that because of the higher temperatures, the permafrost is melting, and that's revealing the vegetation apparently of earlier, I believe we had tropical climate then. And I'm wondering if there's anything of that sort that also happens with composting our vegetation back into the earth here, whether the changing temperatures and so on would end up reintroducing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from the degrading of these products.
So, like when you compost in your backyard, is that what you're talking about, Judith?
Yes, but okay. like if there's anything a connection between that and the what happens with the melting of the permafrost, because something is then being exposed and producing carbon dioxide in the process of degrading down.
Thanks, Judith. Interesting call.
Well, what we know is happening in the permafrost in the tundra is very concerning in that as it thaws, which it is doing, it emits methane, which many of the listeners probably have heard is a much more potent heat-trapping gas than is even carbon dioxide. And so the melting of the permafrost creates what we call a permanent a positive feedback loop, in that the more warming we get, the more heat-trapping methane is released, and we get this vicious cycle. With regard to your compost, there's not really a linkage between your compost pile and permafrost, but what we know is that when you compost organic materials and keep them out of a landfill, if you aerate it, they produce CO2, which is not a wonderful thing, except it's better than what happens if you don't aerate your compost pile, which is that it becomes anaerobic and produces methane. So we would prefer that you either keep your compost pile well aerated, or and that we're also looking for municipalities and industries to move their organic waste into anaerobic digesters, where the methane that's produced during the anaerobic digestion can be used as fuel.
Mark Lowry is in studio with us, a climate policy analyst with the state DEC and the manager of the Climate Smart Communities program. Paul in Irondequoit, thanks for calling Connections.
I'm all for efficiency. That's what I'm thinking of, like the anabolic thing you just mentioned. I think it's great. Now, here's where I differ on someone calling it climate change. Because we have leadership that does not respond, and they also are not truthful. For instance, and I don't mean to get into a big thing about it, the DEC has not responded on several issues. Also, our governor has a person that advises him that was in Rolling Stones magazine saying that by 2020, the trees are going to be gone in the Adirondacks. They've also cited rising water levels along the coast. But when there's big hurricanes or anything like that, they let everybody build right up to the edge of the water. So it's hard for me to have faith in the climate change thing, but at the same time, I want to see efficiencies improve dramatically. I mean, it costs so much for energy for everybody, for everything.
Absolutely.
And that's about my comment right there.
All right, Paul, thanks for taking the time, and let's have Mark respond. Go ahead, Mark.
I'm not sure I can respond to much of that comment, but I certainly would agree that energy efficiency and energy conservation are the very first things that we recommend in terms of greenhouse gas mitigation, greenhouse gas emission reduction. A large part of our Climate Smart Communities program is designed to help communities identify ways in which they can improve their efficiencies. NYSERDA offers a lot of financial backing as well as technical assistance to municipalities, businesses, individuals in improving their reducing their use of energy through efficiency. But energy efficiency is necessary but not sufficient.
All right, so we're going to get to the phones here in just a second, and we're going to get back to the phones in just a second because they're on fire. But go ahead, Frank.
Yes, I just wanted to make one point about the last comment, and that is one of the reasons why we're doing this program with the DEC with Mark Lowry is that governments don't have the luxury of avoiding things like your livelihood, your health, in your life. There is no substitute for the government. I think one of the our government is accountable to us. Well, it's so important that we talk with our government about climate change because other people just have ideas. They have ideas or out there making a business or something. But our government is actually has to do something. They can't sit around and not do something. They have to have a policy. But you at least you can respond to that.
Yeah, I go ahead, Peter.
And another thing to add to that is that I think we should be particularly proud of the fact that New York State has taken a leadership position on this, established a climate change office and this program. And for citizens who are not living in one of the communities that we mentioned that have already signed on, we will have postcards with a message urging your community to get onto this program, Climate Smart, available at the church tonight that you can just sign your name on and send it to your town council people to get a change in your community.
What does it take to become part of Climate Smart Communities, Mark?
Well, so you have to be a village, county, city, or town. So all 1,600-plus such governments are eligible. What they have to do is adopt the Climate Smart Community Pledge. They adopt it through their legislative body, whether that's a village board or a county legislature or county board of supervisors or city common council. It's not sufficient to have the mayor sign a proclamation. We want the full sign of full community support. But the pledge itself is completely voluntary. There's absolutely nothing mandatory, nothing that would lead us to issue a notice of violation or anything like that. It outlines a very general local approach because it's flexible, and we recognize we have communities that range in size from 8 million to a few hundred, and we've tried to design a program that any community that's interested can participate in.
Okay, they're going to be talking about that tonight. And before we get back to the phones, we keep talking about, and Paul and Arondakoit just mentioned the fact that so much of our economy, so much of what we spend on energy is expensive. We have a carbon economy. And yet this UN report says if we reduce emissions and get off of carbon by 72% by 2050, it's only going to shave 6/100ths of a percentage point off of global growth. How do you believe that? Mark, how can we possibly believe that reducing carbon that much isn't going to cost our economy more?
One of the things that's happened in the last decade or so is that renewables have become much closer to being cost-effective against fossil fuels than they were, again, even a decade or so ago. Residential solar is becoming quite cost-effective against even natural gas in supplying your home with power, and that's simply because of improvements in efficiency of the technology.
So is it as simple as saying that we believe that as one industry falls, another rises to replace it economically?
I think so. It's that creative disruption that occurs throughout many sectors of our economy.
And human beings are very good at that, but we better hope so. Because if we want to reduce emissions drastically, we're talking about huge changes to industries that rely on carbon. Fair to say?
Correct, but new industries are rising. And it's really time for energy for fossil fuel companies to see themselves as energy companies and begin to diversify.
Keith and Menden, thanks for calling. Keith, go ahead.
I have an interesting show. Yeah, a couple callers ago, the doubting gentleman who called, maybe I can possibly put it in simpler terms that he and others may understand. If you have a million tons of coal and you dig it up from the earth and you burn it, you get heat, you'll get some ash, but the carbon combines with oxygen to create carbon dioxide. There's nothing you can do about that in the short term. Now, you take all the centuries that we've burned stuff, it will increase the level of carbon dioxide. Now, there's some people who say, well, to get rid of the carbon dioxide, let's plant all these trees and other organic plants that will use the carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. Well, in theory, that works, but if you planted a trillion trees tomorrow and they all grew, eventually the trees are going to die, they're going to decompose, and they're going to put the carbon dioxide back into the air. The problem that we've created is we've taken sequestered carbon-based energy forms, i.e. natural gas, oil, and coal that were within the ground, very static, and we started to burn them to an excess where it's dumping all this extra carbon dioxide in the air that we can't get it out. Now, the ultimate goal would be if we could commercially create photosynthesis, would take care of that, but yet we can't do that.
Well, thanks, Keith. Thanks for the call. Let's let Mark respond.
Couldn't agree more. he took part of my presentation.
All right. We've got a few more calls, and for our callers, I'm going to get to you right now. Try to keep it to 30 seconds because we got to move. Charlotte in the city, go ahead.
Hi. I'm interested in learning what me, as a member of the public who doesn't have a lot of money to contribute to political campaigns, what could I do that could cause the state to strengthen this program? Because, quite frankly, it sounds pretty tepid compared to what we need to do.
A good question, Charlotte. Thank you.
I think that the answer to what an individual can do, the standard answer is, drive more slowly, drive an electric vehicle, replace all your light bulbs with LEDs or CFLs. But I think the true answer is to vote well. And I'm not suggesting you vote for any particular candidate, but when you vote or when election time comes around or when you talk with your elected officials, ask them what they are doing about climate change and hold them accountable to it. You can always participate in the political process locally at the state level and nationally, obviously, by writing letters, making phone calls, and you can certainly talk to the agencies as well.
Pete, go ahead, Pete.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for calling, Pete. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to suggest a speaker for the next Sierra Club event, and that would be the civil and environmental engineer Mark Jacobson, who, along with a co-author, produced a study that came to the conclusion that we could power the world without fossil fuels by 2030, and also a follow-up study of New York State, which concluded the same thing. Now, the governor's office is aware of this study. I'd like to know, first from the Sierra Club, if they're aware of Mark Jacobson's study, if they are planning on inviting him to speak around the state, and to the state rep, I'd like to know what, if any, is being done with the information that the governor's office has.
Okay, thanks, Pete. Familiar with Mr. Jacobson?
I'm not, but why don't you come over tonight at 5:30 p.m. at First Unitarian Church on 2200 South Avenue.
You better you better say that again.
South Winton.
And join us in a conversation. We hope a lot of people will be there with a lot of suggestions, a lot of ideas, and you got questions, and we want to talk.
Mark, on the state side?
On the state side, first of all, I want to clarify, I'm not a direct representative of the governor. I certainly at some level work for the governor, but I'm a number of levels down, and I'm not privy to everything that goes on in the governor's office. I'm familiar with the studies that you reference. What I would suggest you do is understand that the state has a draft state energy plan out for public comment. Take a look at that. If you believe that what's the contents of that draft state energy plan do not are not consistent with this work that you've cited, I would suggest you make that comment.
Mike, got to be very quick. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. My question is that I'd like to know who in the Sierra Club, have you ever pressured any of our American manufacturers? It's fine, and it's fine to talk about cleaning up pollution, which we all want in this country. But if you ever take a visit to third world countries like China, Pakistan, you'll see that the pollution is so bad it reminds you of going back to the 19th century here. I'd like to know why no pressure is put on American manufacturers who outsource to countries that burn coal, particularly China, which burns a lot of coal,
yeah,
which contributes a lot of pollution.
Thanks, Mike.
All we're doing is shifting, making it clean in this country, but we don't really care about what happens to people in third world countries.
Mike, thank you for that. And real quick, go ahead there, Frank.
Yes, I think on a local level, we don't have much to do with that, though. On a national level, the Sierra Club is the largest environmental and longest environmental group in the world. And many of the things that we do, I just signed a petition today going against the corporations with their bad environmental policies. It's one of the Sierra, it's at a national level, but incredible things are done at this level, trying to get corporations to become really green, not just green to make it look like they're green, but really become green. It's one of the major goals that we have. On a local level, we are just a part of it. On the national level, there are world leaders on this.
Yes, I'd like to add into that, too, that with over a million members of the club, we do have an effect on this, and we have used it with effect on corporations on particular issues. And if you would come to the church tonight and stop by the Sierra Club table, we can give you more information on that and examples of where it has worked.
You can meet Mark Lowry tonight. One more time, Pete, tonight?
Tonight. Come for the environmental fire starting around 5:30 and see the different environmental groups that are active in our area. And then the program begins at 7 o'clock with our speaker, and he will do a PowerPoint presentation followed by an hour of community conversation, questions, and answers.
And you can learn all about the Climate Smart Communities program. The problem as I see it, Mark, is that I agree with the notion of human innovation. One industry falls, carbon, something else rises to replace it. But it's got to be scalable, and it's going to happen sooner or later if we're going to affect emissions. My concern is that economically, I don't know if it's scalable fast enough. I hope I'm wrong.
So do I. We're doing our best to make sure that we do it fast enough.
Okay, well, there's a lot of questions about economic impact. Tim in Pittsburgh, thanks for taking the time to call. I couldn't get to all of them this hour. Great conversation. Mark, thanks to you,
thank you,
for taking the time, and thanks to Frank and Peter tonight. I know they've got an event, and if people want to join that conversation, you can continue it tonight in Rochester. That's why Mark is here today. Been a great week here on Connections, and thanks for all the interaction. Tomorrow, Healthy Friday. I'll see you Monday. Have a great day.